Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. Her name is Laurel K. Hamilton. She's a major New York Times best-selling author, and her latest is the 20th Anita Blake book called Hit List. Hello.
Hi, David. It's wonderful to be here.
It's wonderful to have you on the show. You're so big in this. In this. I mean, you're quite huge in this. And what do we call your books? They're sort of a mix of fantasy and horror and. How do you classify them?
I actually call them paranormal thrillers. Okay. That seems to cover everything.
There's a lot of interesting stuff in your book. What I love about your books is that you never know what's coming next. You never know what kind of animal or something. You never know what's going to happen next.
Well, you know, it's my job to be, you know, unexpected and do things that will keep everybody interested. But, you know, I think real life is like that. I don't know about how your life runs, but my life is always full of surprises, so
right.
I try to keep my fiction as interesting.
And you like it that way?
I do. I have to say that there was a time for myself that I thought, you know, I was looking for things quieting down, and then I finally realized they're never going to quiet down, so I decided to enjoy it.
But you enjoy writing. I mean, writing is really important to you.
It is. I am very, very lucky. I love my job. I have loved it for all these years, and it's all I really wanted to do in a major way since I was about 14, and very few people get to make a living, and a good living, be successful at what they have in their heart at 14, you know?
So that's great. That means you're only 34 now.
No, at about a decade.
But what I love about you is you speak your mind. You're very honest about things, and you're very successful. I mean, and you weren't successful at first. You had a lot of rejections, and yet you never gave up. Why didn't you give up?
Guilty Pleasures had over 200 rejections. So why didn't I give up? It never occurred to me to give up, to be honest.
Did you know that you'd get published eventually?
Well, I had one book purchased, and Nightseer. That was my first book I ever wrote, and it was purchased. It didn't sell well enough, so they didn't want the second book. And what I thought was going to be my career suddenly wasn't. There was that bleak time where I really wasn't sure if I was ever going to make this my day job. And then I had all those rejections for Guilty Pleasures, and that was I really wasn't sure. I had the few short stories sold. I didn't give up on Guilty Pleasures because I've never had such good rejection slips. Editors said they didn't know what to do with it. It was mixed genre, and they, you know, the horror publishers thought it was science fiction thought it was fantasy, fantasy thought it was mystery. Everybody recommended other editors to send it to. It was the weirdest thing. They loved the book, didn't know what to do with it.
That's so interesting to hear that. I mean, 200 rejections. You think, I mean, most people give up after four or five. A lot of people would anyway. They just say, well, I'm not going to get published, and that's all there is to it. But you have such a drive.
Why would you give up for only five rejections? There's plenty of publishers left.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
It's the only true failure in my book is to not try.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, you are not defeated. You haven't failed. You just haven't succeeded yet.
Right. And most people, I would guess that a lot of authors that have been published had a failure at one point in their life.
Actually, I talk to a lot of beginning writers or would-be writers across the country, and they will say, oh, I just couldn't take the rejection. And then I'll ask them, how many times was this book that you've now put in a drawer and don't want to send out, how many times was it rejected? And they always say, you know, five or under. And then I say, I was rejected over 200 times. For Guilty Pleasures. So I kind of look at them and go, dudette, you know, it's just, take it back out, dust it off, send it back out.
Right. You knew you had your audience out there somewhere. You knew
it. No, I didn't.
Really?
How would I possibly know? I wrote this book in the late 80s.
Yeah.
Which means that nobody had done this before. Nobody had mixed genre successfully. Vampires were not hot in the late 80s. P&L Rod was the only one I was aware of that was mixing mystery and vampires, and hers was very different from this. I had not yet read Tanya Huff when I wrote this book. So the whole paranormal thing with all the vampires and the werewolves and were-animals, that hadn't happened yet. I had written something so unique that I had people loving it, but they said they couldn't figure out how to market it. that it was mixed genre. Mixed genre didn't sell. I had one editor tell me that vampires were a dead genre.
But you write well. I mean, just reading Hit List over the weekend, the new one, Hit List, I love the way you write your characters. I love the way the characters interact with each other. It's really wonderful to read. I mean, you sit down, and before you know it, you're totally lost in these characters.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And you do that very, very well. You have a talent for that, a big talent. So that's why I was saying, I think you knew you had some kind of talent.
I had talent, but you said that I knew I would find an audience.
Right. I kind of get that feeling that you had a determination that you knew they were out there somewhere. I don't know. I just kind of felt that from you.
Eventually, I felt I would find a voice. But now, look at it this way. If my first novel, Nightseer was more traditional, somewhere between Conan the Barbarian and Tolkien. If that had sold, I might have spent my career doing heroic fantasy. But because the bottom had just fallen out of the fantasy market, I had to go back through all my ideas, anything that I could find that was different. And one of those was an unpublished short story that had Anita Blake in it. So if I had succeeded wildly with my first, or even semi, I would never have pushed myself to do something so different.
Right. I love Anita. I mean, Anita, as soon as you read about Anita, you just are immediately intrigued by her. I mean, she's somebody different than we've ever seen it. And you really carved out a niche that nobody else has done as well as you have. I mean, who else comes even close to you in the way you write and the way you, in your, what you've done with your books?
Well, thank you. I can't answer that. I don't read that widely in my own genre. When I get up from the computer, I don't want to read something else that kind of plays in the same field. Anita has been fun from the moment I wrote her. I've loved her voice. And I love following her around and playing in her world with her. And I love all the characters. They really have become my imaginary friends. I've been writing them a decade now, and I miss them between books.
Yeah.
And I think that shows. I think if you really love your characters and your world, that really shows when you're writing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the other people that have come up after me, they're not in love with their characters. They're not in love with their world. And there's nothing wrong with that. Some of them are making a good living at it. But I think that part of it that makes the difference is literally I'm in love with the people that I write. I'm in love with my world. And anything done with love and attention to craft, it just shows. And I'm still having a great time.
Now let's talk about Hit List. Hit List is the 20th book. How do you approach each book? I mean, do you just know where you're going, or does it happen as you're writing it? How does that work?
I know the beginning. I know vaguely the end. I know who done it or what done it, and I usually know where we're going. I know some major events in the middle, and beyond that, I have a clue list for the mystery, and then beyond that, I write to get from point A to point G. I don't always know how we're going to get there. And part of the thing for me, though, I found as a writer, if I outline too much, I've already written the book. The impetus to write the book is gone. I actually write so I can read it.
Hmm.
And so that is very important to me, to not outline too much, to not know too much about what's happening in the book. Because if I know too much ahead of time, then I really feel like I've already been there, done that. To me, I have to keep the writing fresh for me to keep me interested in the book myself as a writer.
Now, you've been doing that since the first book. Is it the same way you've done it for every book?
Yes. Guilty Pleasures was even more so because I actually did not know who had done it in the first book. And it was only as I wrote the book and got closer to the end that I went, oh, okay, that was my first mystery that I'd ever written as well.
Hmm.
So it was definitely, with Guilty Pleasures, I was lucky. I was lucky that it turned out as well as it did because I was really walking around in the dark. With each book, I've gotten better and more sure of myself, and I know how to structure things. But in many ways, that first novel, the very first beginning of the series, was really the luckiest of them because I'd done my research and I'd read a lot of hard-boiled mysteries, which is what the voice is based on, but I I'd never done it before. It's, you know, you can study, you can practice, but until you get up on, you know, up on whatever stage you want to call it and really do it for real, you don't know if it's going to work.
How would you describe Hit List for people who haven't? I want to talk a little bit about the book, and because it's such a terrific book.
Oh, well, thank you. For people who aren't familiar with Anita, it is our world if we woke up tomorrow and all the things that go bump in the night were real. And Anita is a U.S. Marshal with the preternatural branch of the service. She is a legal vampire executioner. So if a monster, were animal, or vampire does something bad and kills people, they're too dangerous to try to put in jail. So you literally get a warrant of execution and you hunt them down and you can kill them. No trial. It is a civil rights nightmare waiting to happen. But we start Hit List first page with a serial killer victim on the ground with Anita and U.S. Marshal Ted Forrester, alias Edward.
Right.
Sitting there looking at the body, trying to figure out how to keep any more people from dying. And they are pretty sure they know who did it, but they can't prove it. And it doesn't do them any good because they can't find them.
Right.
And it's this was a book back to solving the crimes, to really looking at what it would be if you were a police work and trying to work within a system that had so much mystical stuff in it, and it really, really worked. It would be really much harder to be a policeman if metaphysics worked to this degree. You would need somebody that would help you, that could work through the system, work with the monsters rather than against them. Or I don't know how you catch anybody a lot of the time.
What's good about Hit List is you actually, after the book's done, you still see some of the scenes in your head. I mean, some of the great scenes. I don't want to talk too much about them. I don't want to give anything away. Cause
I understand.
It's hard to talk about it because you want to talk about things, and people that haven't read it will say, no, stop, I haven't read it yet, you know. The worst thing you can do is spoil a book for somebody.
I know. I've had to be so careful. Thank you. The scenes are vivid. I had so much fun researching. We actually got Edward to use a weapon that I'd never gotten to use on screen before.
And cool.
That was a very fun scene to do. And looking for different, again, I'm trying not to give it away, because it is a surprise when he pulls it out.
Right.
There was film online that helped me go back through and look at it and go, how would that work? How would that work? How would that work? And I talked to my friends that were military, ex-military, and had to use them, so that I would try to be as accurate as possible. And it was very fun to. It's always fun when he brings the dangerous toys.
Do you get to write anything you want? Do they give you any limits, or do you have free rein to write any kind of anything in these books that you want?
Have free reign at this point. I've had other people ask me, you know, have they ever made you cut down the sexual content? No, they haven't. The only time I've been questioned about the sex really was that in one of the Meredith Gentry novels, A Lick of Frost, they wanted me to put in an extra sex scene. Yes, I know, that's surprising. But
really?
An extra sex scene.
Oh, wow.
And I honestly have kept waiting for somebody in New York to just throw the flag down and go, no more. You've gone too far. No one's ever done it. No one's ever told me I've gone too far. And so...
Not even your audience? Not even your readers? Will they tell you?
I have some readers that are unhappy with the sexual content. I have some readers that are unhappy with... sorry, that's a spoiler late in the series. Let's just say that some people do not agree with some of the choices that Anita has made in her personal life. And but actually, it's the minority of people that are bothered by the sex. The majority of readers are happy with it. And in fact, one of the things I'm hearing from Hit List is that I haven't managed to get more people on stage, and I haven't had more of her men on stage. I'm sorry, in the middle of a serial killer investigation, there just wasn't time to go home for a nookie run.
Right.
but I, what I'm hearing from fans is that they love the book, and the few complaints I'm getting are mostly that they wanted to see some of the other characters that they really love.
Right.
I have such a great cast of people that it's hard to not try to put everybody on stage, but there's just too many. The ensemble cast has gotten too big.
I'd actually like to see a full list of all the characters in all the books. I don't know if you can get that online. I looked around for it. I couldn't find anything really. But I would love to see that full list, have something to look back on when you're reading the books. I think it would help out an awful lot.
Well, we're talking very seriously about doing an Anitapedia. People have been asking for that kind of thing and various other things, and doing an Anitapedia. We're talking back and forth on what kind of format that would be now. We talked everything from it being electronic, so you guys can just look online, to it starting out as a book, and then maybe being online.
Oh, I'd love to see it as a book. That would be really cool. And I could go back and read all the rest of them. I could know who what character was. That may help so much.
Well, the thing is, though, if we do it as a book, there's no way to put every character in.
There's just too many of them.
Think about it. The book would have to be, you need like a steam shovel to cart it around or something.
Exactly.
If you did minor characters, now if you just did major characters, you could do it probably, but minor characters, I mean, this is the 20th novel. There's too many minor characters. There are people that just walk into a scene and you don't see them again.
Right.
You'd have to start winnowing down. We have been talking about it for a while, and we're beginning, hopefully this year we'll solidify what form it is going to be in, and then we'll look at doing it next year, which means it wouldn't be out for 2 years.
Right, and you have graphic novels coming out, which is exciting. I mean, it's a lot of exciting things happening to you.
It's very exciting. Yes, the graphic novels, we're finishing up Circus of the Damned in that. We did an original prequel to Guilty Pleasures called The First Death, and I co-wrote that with my husband, Jonathan Green, and it was very fun. I could never write a novel that's a prequel to Guilty Pleasures, but one of the things I learned with the comics is that the pictures take up a lot of what I spend my time writing in a novel, because you don't have the visuals, and I don't have to dwell inside the heads of the characters as much. Mostly a comic script is dialogue. I do great dialogue. I'm really fast at it. And I don't have to do all the introspection because the pictures take the place of that. And the readers put a lot of themselves into it, so they do their own introspection. It's one of the ways that I can do things that I can't figure out how to do in a novel because I can't think like that. For instance, we're talking about doing a standalone Edward comic.
With new
adventures, and the assassin's so dangerous that he started specializing in things, monsters.
And you are really good at back and forth dialogue. I really there's a lot of authors I read and it's very boring, but you make it very interesting, back and forth and back and forth. I love that. I love reading the scenes between Anita and these other characters and what they say to one another, and you build a scene really well too, which is really cool. It sort of reminds me of the movie Alien, where things happen all of a sudden, something major happens. You do that really well too. I really like that.
Well, thank you.
Is that hard to do?
Yeah, it is. It is hard to do. It's easier. It's easier now. But when I first started writing, all the way back in high school, when I first started seriously trying to send out and started collecting my first rejection slips on stories, I just have a tendency to figure out what I'm bad at and try to get better at it. So I figured it, I realized I couldn't write a fight scene to save my life. So what I started to write heroic fantasy, which is almost all fight scenes. Then I realized I couldn't do dialogue very well, so I decided to do hard-boiled detective fiction, which is almost all dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized I couldn't do a decent kiss on paper. So what did I do? I not only do a wonderful kiss on paper now, but I do. I have yet to see somebody who does better sex on paper than I do. And I'm not saying it's not out there. I haven't read everything, but I'm very. Everything that I saw as a weakness, I worked at till it became a strength. And dialogue is one of those. I was always pretty good at building a scene, but dialogue I had to actually learn. And one of the ways I did that was Robert B. Parker's Spencer series, the early Spencer books.
Yeah, I know you like those a lot.
That was where I learned how to do dialogue. If you read those books and you you read if you read the dialogue from both series, you will see the rhythm of it still there, like an echo in mine sometimes still.
I wonder, I mean, and I hope this doesn't embarrass you for me to ask this question, but I wonder, your life, when we read your books, and there is a lot of sex, we wonder what your life is like. Do you get this from, you obviously don't get it all from real life, but I mean, I'm curious. Is it wrong for me to be curious?
It's not wrong for you to be curious, but I'll tell you what I tell people when I do events out across the country. You ask the question, I'll answer it, but you have to ask the whole question. What do you want to know?
I want to know I'm not quite sure what I want to know. I just, your sex scenes are so real that I feel like maybe you're living them yourself, too.
Well, I am not living all of them because I don't have that many friends I like.
I wasn't trying to imply that you were with multiple partners or anything.
That's not it. I'm just saying that I think at last count, Anita is having some kind of ongoing relationship with I think we're over at 12 or over. I have to count myself. I'd have to count in my head and go down the list at this point. But I think one of the biggest, multiple partners are fine, but that many? Dear Lord.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest fictions I write is that any one person could have a meaningful relationship with that many people. You can have sex with that many people periodically, but there's no way to date that many people.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
what I want to know is this your? Do you have fantasies about all this stuff? I mean, in your life, have you had fantasies about the stuff that you write about? Maybe that's what I want to know.
Actually, some of the sex on paper is some of the sex is something that I enjoy, and some of the sex is choices that my characters make.
I'm getting too personal here. I'm sorry.
No. I think you're sort of asking the question, and you're not asking the question.
Because I'm nervous about asking the question, probably.
Which is probably why across the country, most people just give up. I go, ask the question. Most people don't want to ask what they really want to ask, because it does make people uncomfortable to ask about sex. I'm not uncomfortable about sex. Sex is a wonderful thing, and it should be fun, and you should enjoy it. And
well, that's what's good about your book. You make it seem beautiful, too. It doesn't seem dirty in Hit List at all. It seems very beautiful.
It is beautiful. I've never been anybody who, I don't understand casual. I've never been a casual person in any way. So for me, sex has always been meaningful and important. And it is, even if it's not somebody that is your one and only, for me, it is still one of the most intimate things. You're giving all of yourself to somebody. You're saying, this is me, all of me, physically. You can, but it's never just physical. If it's done right, and it's the only way I know how to do it, it really is that you give all of yourself to someone. In that moment, you are not thinking about anything else. You are there with the people in that room, in that moment, and it is wonderful. It is beautiful.
I wonder what your fans say to you. I'm dying to know what they say to you. I can imagine all this stuff. I know Stephen King tells the story of somebody bringing up a little packet of blood to one of his signings, and I can only imagine what your fans do to you.
Well, they will ask about size, both of my imaginary friends, which is interesting, and they will ask how well endowed my husband is.
Oh, really?
And I answer the same for my imaginary friends as for my husband. I don't kiss and tell. You know I'm not going to answer that question kind of thing.
Right.
I have, the sexual propositions have gone down as the sexual content has gone up, which you would think would be the other way around. A male friend explained it. He says he thinks that the men are afraid that if they asked and I said yes, that they wouldn't measure up. The level of sex in the books is so good that it's intimidating, apparently. You know what? I think that maybe one sexual content went even further because that was kind of uncomfortable.
What do you wish people would ask about? Are there things you wish people would ask questions about?
No, I don't impose what I want people to do onto other people. I'm a big, big believer in free will and letting people find for themselves what they want.
They're obviously very curious about your books. Now, do you leave hints in each book as to what the next book's going to be about?
Sometimes.
Did you do it for Hit List?
I don't believe I did. I think it's pretty finished. Well, in a way, there's a hint in Bullet and some hints in Hit List. Bullet is the book before, about what is one of the possible next plots for the next Anita book. There was something that was more mentioned in Bullet that we left kind of hanging that we need to go look at. And I don't do that on purpose all the time. Sometimes I do. I've actually sat down and I thought I knew the next Anita plot, and then I made notes on this other idea I've been messing about with for about 3 years, 4 years maybe, and suddenly I had more on that than the idea I thought I was going to be doing.
Do you get to pick all your covers? Do they let you have, do you get to choose what's going to be on the final book?
I get input, and sometimes I get more than others, and if something really bothers me, they listen. But generally speaking, I kind of let the art department do their job, and then we go back and forth with it. This cover, they showed it to me, and I just went, cool.
You liked it right away.
Yeah. Well, see, I don't just look at covers as art. One of my jobs in college was I worked in a bookstore.
Oh, good for you.
Thank you. And it's left me with a permanent understanding that covers are packaging, just like in the grocery store. And what do I mean by that? It means that I take every cover flat they send me, and I put it X far away. And what I'm seeing is, if I was walking through the mall, and I passed the window display, and I caught that cover out of the corner of my eye, would I stop and look at it? I put it the distance away that it would be in one of the big department stores, and as you're walking down the aisle, pushing your groceries and going to go get dog food or baby food or clothes or whatever you're going, if you saw that cover, would it distract you enough to make you look at it again? That's a good cover. It's great that my name is big. It's great that the title's clear. It's great that it's pretty. But really, what you want your cover to do is get people to look at it and want to pick it up. That's what a cover's for.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look at all covers like that. Is it intriguing? Does it look? And if you look at it, it's just, and I actually go around showing it to everybody and different people and say, what do you think of the cover? I'll get other people's opinions, not just the same people every time, because
right.
You want fresh opinions. So covers go through a lot here. I go, look at this, and I put it different distances away. Does it work at each distance? Does it not? Your cover is the first thing that a new reader especially sees.
Right.
So covers really are important, but I'm not sure that it's as important what's on the cover is that it just attracts the eye, if that makes sense.
And this one certainly attracts the eye. There's no doubt about that.
Yes, doesn't it, though?
And you look at it and you think, well, can I see everything? Am I seeing everything right? And you're looking underneath to try to, and it almost looks like it's 3D. Almost like you can pull it up and see underneath.
isn't it a wonderful effect? It really does have that feel of a special effect, like you should have a fly leaf to lift up. It's one of the things I liked about it when I saw it in New York and saw it finished product-wise. And I like the emboss. I like how it's raised. It
right.
actually has texture to it, so it's pettable. I'm very tactile.
Right.
And so it was very interesting that it's one of the covers that makes me want to pet it.
You're one of these people that, just talking to you, I realize that you're so interesting. There's so many facets to you. You're not just sometimes I talk to an author and you can tell they're just not very interesting, but you're interesting. What's going to happen? Are there going to be any movies based on these or TV shows or what?
I don't know.
Do you want there to be?
It would be fun to have. I've really enjoyed seeing the comics and having a visual for the characters that I've been playing with for so long. It would be wonderful to look up on the screen and see the characters and have them just look like they've stepped out of the books. That would make me very happy. I have to say that now that I've looked into it and know more about how the process works, though, I am even more in awe of how you take a book and turn it into a movie, because especially a movie, an ongoing series, you can kind of portion it out plot-wise. But a book going to the screen, to the big screen, you take say it's a short one of my say it's a 400-page book. Most of mine are longer than that. Say it's a 400-page book. Most scripts are between 120 pages and 160 pages. So you have to take 400 pages and you have to winnow it down to 120, 160. That's it. That's all you got. And it is an art form, a true art form, to be able to take a book that big and put it into a script that small and have both the book, it still be true to the book, and be a good movie.
Would you insist that it be true to the book?
It can't be. It can't be absolutely point by point by point, and I learned that again through the comics.
And that's the beauty of you as a writer. Nothing will ever match what you write for us.
No.
Nothing
can't.
Will.
It can't. But one of the things that was very interesting in doing the comics was that what worked on in the novel, sometimes when you put visuals with it, and the visuals weren't moving, they're just the still visuals, you needed more dialogue. The way I wrote it, it's very intense, but when you wrote it out in scene, in one scene that was so intense, it's just people walking down a very long corridor for a long time. There were several scenes of it. And
the movie might be rated X the way some of your books are.
Well, now, if you did the sex in the later books, that would be... It could be done, but it would be interesting. I'm told that that there wouldn't be a lot that they couldn't do. I don't know. I really don't know how they would do it. How they would do the sex scenes.
They'd never be able to do justice to what you write. That's the problem. You're the only writer that makes any sense to us. I mean, anything else is going to be something not on the same level, not even close.
Well, I really appreciate that.
Well, that's what we love. We love your writing. That's why people read your books, because they love the way you write. And to put that onto a movie, something's going to be different.
Well, the thing is, though, I mean, take Hit List, for instance. How do you pick and choose? How do you pick and choose what goes on the screen and what doesn't? How do you decide that, you know, what part of the plot... you don't need.
And there's always money involved, too. I mean, can they do it, you know, they only have a certain amount of money.
We actually did start to do a series for Anita at one point. We got into the process quite a bit, enough so that I started researching and looking at being a producer and how different, there are different kinds of producers, which I didn't know until I researched it. And one of the things that one type of producer does is they watch the money. How much do things cost? And, dear Lord, things are expensive when you're making a movie.
Right.
Every special effect costs. Every piece of costume, every prop, everything on the screen, you have to look at it. And there's somebody in charge of the final. So, yeah, you have to look at it from that perspective. But the big thing for me is that most special effects really are acting. Most of the movement and stuff is going to be fairly easily done.
And then we have the problem of who's going to play Anita. I can't even imagine if they would get to play Anita.
I think there would be actresses that could play Anita. I think we'd be able to find that. I've seen some that over the years that I've gone, you know, I think she could do it. But, you know, I have yet to see any actor that made me think they're Jean-Claude. I've seen some that made me think Richard... I've seen some that make me think other characters, but I have yet to see anybody that made me think of Jean-Claude. Of course, you know, Hit List is out of town, so that wouldn't be an issue. But is Anita going to be exactly what she looks like in my head? No, I know that. I absolutely know that. I would love to think otherwise, but I've lived with this person for over a decade.
And you're not tired of her yet.
No, I love... Nina really is my imaginary friend. I miss them when I go away from the book. I miss talking to them and being with them.
Would it be wrong for me to ask who we're going to see next year as far as... Will we see Anita or will we see Mary?
Well, you're going to see Anita in June as scheduled. And I'm hoping very much... I've already started. The Mary book will be in December.
Oh, how cool is that?
Of 2012.
Well, we can't know the titles yet, right?
I don't know the titles yet.
Oh,
because
really?
You can't know. I don't know. So, well, I guess you can't know because I can't tell you. Well, I find that early on, I had a naming trope. I knew the title almost before I sat down to write the book. But then somewhere around the 10th or 11th book, I began to not have... I ran out of titles. I just didn't think I'd get this far. I mean, I hoped I'd get this far, but I didn't have that many titles already chosen. And so I'm now left going, huh, I don't have a title for this book.
Do you have favorites of the series? I mean, are there certain books, or is that unfair for me to ask that?
It is sort of like asking which is your favorite kid.
Then I know I shouldn't ask.
Yeah. You know, I have books that I hit milestones that I really enjoyed. You know, book 8, Blue Moon, we went out of town with all the werewolves and everything and finally crossed the bridge with Richard. That was something I didn't think we were going to get to at one point. And Obsidian Butterfly, Edward, going home and seeing where Edward lives. That was really, really fun.
So each book has its own little delights. I mean, you just remember certain things that you love about each little book.
Yeah, very, very much so. I can tell you that I always remember the ones that surprised me, like the character of Micah was a total surprise in how he turned out. He was originally supposed to be a villain.
And people want to see more of him. From what I read online, they can't wait to see more of those other characters.
Very, very much so. I have learned to do technology on Facebook so that I do the little poll where they choose vote things. And the two men that they most want to see more of, two of their favorites, are Jean-Claude and Micah. So that was interesting. And
do you take that in consideration? Will you do that because of what people want?
I will let it weigh heavier if I'm making a choice. I will sit there and lean heavier towards it because I know, you know, the fans would like it. But if it doesn't work for the book, then there's nothing I can do.
Right. Well, you have to stay true to the story, and you know where you want to go with the story. And if it doesn't, if it looks forced, it's not going to look right.
I don't force things, but it was interesting to me that I like hearing feedback. I do. I like hearing feedback, as long as it's positive. And by that I don't mean that they never say anything negative. What I mean is, you can say something that's negative, but you say it in a positive way. Just being mean, I don't listen. If you're just mean, I don't listen to you.
Right. So you don't really listen to the critics too much, as far as what they have to say about your books?
Not really. Well, at this point, I don't read reviews either way.
Did they ever bother you at any time?
They did early on. They did early on. Early on in the career, you give more weight to the critics, you just do. And some people always do. I found that both the bad reviews, of course, because they're bad, would mess with me, but good reviews would also mess with me because I would feel like I couldn't live up to it next time.
Oh, interesting.
So when I realized that both ways bothered me, I just had to stop looking. It would haunt me when I sat down to write the next book. I would think of the reviews and think of things people had said, so I just stopped looking at them. Truthfully, I'm very self-contained at this point, and Anita and I and all the gang, we're pretty solid about who we are and what we do, and I'm not easily swayed anymore. I will listen, and if there's a choice and a chance to lean towards something that the fans wanted, like one of the biggest things they've wanted is more Edward. Well, here's Hit List. It is, I mean, Edward's pretty much almost in every scene.
Right.
And
what a great character.
I love Edward. He has been, his character growth has been one of the biggest surprises and the most, just the most fun of almost any other major minor character. I never know what to call him. I mean, he's a major character, but he's not in every book.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to call that kind of character minor major or major minor, but it's still not a good enough definition. When he's in a book, he's a major character. When he's not, he's off screen.
Do you ever base any of your characters on anybody you've met or somebody similar? Are they similar to somebody you've met? Do you ever do that?
No, I really don't base on real characters. I'm sort of superstitious. Such bad things happen in my books. I'm just can convinced that if I based on a real person, then if they get hurt, die in a book, then, you know, next week the person I based on is going to die. I know that's silly. It's total superstition on my part, but it's how I feel. The closest is actually Edward. I was when I was writing Guilty Pleasures, I was having trouble getting a handle on Edward as a character. And as writers will sometimes do, you just kind of give it up, and you go and you turn on the television. And Day of the Jackal, the original one from either the early 70s or early or 60s, was on.
Right.
With Edward Fox.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that movie, at that moment, was exactly what I needed to help define this character. That's why he's named Edward. So he started out by looking like that actor at that moment, but now he looks totally like himself. I actually saw the movie again recently, and I thought, Edward doesn't look like Edward Fox anymore. He has become his own person. But it really helped me get out of my own way and go, okay, I need him this is sort of what I'm needing. And it helped me kind of winnow down my choices.
When you write, are you writing 7 days a week, or do you take the weekends off? I mean, what is your writing like? I mean, it sounds like you really, really go at it when you write.
I really do. I will often do 7 days a week. In fact, I find in a book if I take even one day off, it hurts my momentum.
Wow. That's true when you read a book too. When you stop reading a book, I found when I stopped reading your book, I lost my momentum, and I needed to go back and you know, read it in a long stretch of time. To sit there out, I was sitting outside on my patio here, just reading the book, enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. And I write like that. It really is a day in, day out process. One of the things that I've learned only in the last couple of years is that because of the way I write, some writers are not like that. In fact, most writers work for 2 to 4 hours maximum a day, and they do maybe 4 to 5 days a week. I will work for 8 hours a day. I will work 7 days a week. And when the book started getting longer, the deadlines began to bump up against each other from the two series. And I had one point where a few years back that I finished one book and the next day started the next one. I so wasn't ready. I so wasn't recovered from the process of writing the
So what do you do from going crazy? I mean, there must be points where it's just too much.
Well, actually, I took some time off. I just talked to my editor and my publisher in New York, and I just went, guys, I got to have more of a break than this. It's one of the reasons that I'm at one publisher now with both series.
Mm-hmm.
Because that way, no matter what book I'm working on, it's theirs.
Right.
And that really does help. What I did was I realized that what I had been doing is trying to take a break between books. But it sometimes, I mean, Hit List took a year to write. And you can't work like that for a solid year without getting a little punchy.
Right.
So what I learned in the last just 2 years was that I need breaks periodic. Before tour, we did a trip up to New Orleans to visit a friend. And this weekend we're going out to visit friends in another state. So we are taking trips. I'm traveling like crazy, but I'm traveling for fun.
And you must get ideas when you travel, too.
I do.
You take a little notebook and write them down? And
sometimes. I mean, I do have a writer's notebook that I take with me, but I have to admit, I've gone high tech. I will usually make notes now on my iPhone.
Oh, good for you.
Well, it's small, it's compact, you can throw it in a pocket.
You're just a really cool person. You just sound like you're a really fun person.
Oh, thank you.
I don't even know you that well. So. I hope your husband's not listening. You know,
he would be okay.
Oh, good.
He's secure. I have a lot of fun. I really enjoy my life. That wasn't true. Say even 4 years ago, I was working so hard. I have described my work ethic is draconian. It really is. I am the hardest taskmaster for myself you will ever meet. And I finally realized I couldn't keep this up. It just, you can't forever. My muse and I were tired. We needed to fill the tank back up. And so I started hitting the gym in a serious way. I find that moving my body helps me move my mind. Not to mention that my body feels better. Being in a smaller dress size, that's great, but I feel better. I have better energy, better concentration. I'm writing better going to the gym on a regular basis.
Will there be an end to the Nene Blake series? I mean, will you know when it's at the end, or is there no end in sight?
There's no end in sight. So many people, every book, there's always that rumor that this is the last book. So I've decided that I'll take a page out of Breck Stout, who wrote the Nero Wolfe books. I'll take a page out of his. And if you count all the novelettes, there's about 75 books. So depending on how you count it. So I've decided that that's what I'm telling people now. I'm aiming at 75. The fact that I would have to live to be about, 250, 300 years old to be able to do that many books or something. I don't know how long I'd have to live to do that many books. But I figure if I tell people 75 is a goal, this rumor may stop. But it probably won't. People love a good rumor. They just can't help themselves.
Right. Well, I didn't hear a rumor about that. I just brought that. I just was curious about that. So.
It is every book, though. It hits the internet. Every book, no matter which series I'm doing, it hits every book that this is it. And no matter how many times I say it, so I've started answering the question with that and seeing what people say. But I'm having a wonderful time. If I ever come to a point where I'm not enjoying playing with Anita and the gang, then maybe. But I can't imagine it. I mean, Mary will have an end. I'm doing one book so we can see the twins born on the outside, because I think the fans would have hunted me down had they not.
Right.
And I have one idea that is a few years down the road after that one. I don't know. I don't know if there will be another idea. It depends. I find that one book will give me other ideas and new ideas, sometimes a lot of them. Sometimes I just suddenly know what the next book is going to be at the end of one book.
I'm suddenly curious about what your family thinks about your writing. What your husband? I'm sure your husband loves it. Do you have sisters and brothers?
I have one sister.
What does she think about your writing?
She thinks what I do is great. She's a big
good for her.
She's very proud of me.
Not that you need the approval. I'm sure you're very self-confident, which is nice.
I am.
And you really don't care that people don't like your books. I sense that. Am I wrong?
Well, you can't really care one way or the other. It's nice to be liked. It's much better to be liked than to be disliked.
Right.
I much prefer it. But
you're too interesting for have people to dislike them. I don't know how people could dislike them. They're too interesting.
I actually had one of the reasons I stopped listening to the negative people about the books and stuff and about myself is that after meeting me at an event, one of the people went online and complained that I was too nice, that my husband was with me at the time, as out of the event with me. And so he complained that my husband and I were too nice, that nobody's that nice. He couldn't find anything else to complain about. So he complained that we were too nice.
Wow.
And I thought, dear Lord, you have to find something to complain about. You have to find something.
Do they expect you to be some kind of really mean person because you write such violent books?
Well, this was somebody who didn't like my writing, who had come and he was determined to make a fuss and make me feel bad. But I was so nice he couldn't do it.
Do you get recognized on the street?
I have. I do.
Does that bother you when they say something?
It did at first, but that was because as a writer, you just don't anticipate it. As a writer, when it first started to happen, movie stars maybe, actors of some kind, singers even, you kind of expect it. But as a writer, you just don't think about yourself as kind of a visible person.
Right.
So at first it bothered me, but no, it doesn't bother me. I just, I go, usually they're nice. Usually it's, I love your books, I love it, and it's great. And I say, I'm glad you're enjoying it, glad you're having fun, and people are usually well-behaved when they're looking you dead in the eye. Usually.
Well, I can't wait to go and read a lot of your other books now. I'm so taken with this series. I'm serious. I really want to read them. I found myself thinking, I wish I'd read them all from the beginning. Because I haven't. I must admit, I haven't read them all. So I didn't want you to be upset by that. But
oh, no, I'm not upset. My ego is secure. I write a lot of books. It's okay that you haven't caught up.
I have, but I do have work with a girl at a bookstore who has read every one of your books, and who actually, at some point, I'd love to get a signed copy for her of your book. But you know, she's read everything you've written, and she's
well, and I love to hear that because I've enjoyed writing everything, and the fact that I still love my job and love my imaginary friends to this degree is both it's a wonderful thing, and it seems to be rare. I know a lot of people who do series work, and most of them seem to kind of become disenchanted with their own characters or their own world at some point, somewhere between book 5 and book 8, usually.
Right. It sounds to me like every book is a challenge to you, though. So every new book is a new challenge.
Yeah, and I always try to think in a book, what can I do that I haven't done before? What can I do to push myself to do something I haven't? You know, is there a way to do a fight scene that I have never done before? Is there a way to do a relationship scene, a relationship talk? I know that the next book that Anita will be doing, we'll doing more active LDR, long distance relationship. What does that mean? It means that she's going to get to learn how to text, and she's going to have to do the phone calls home to people. And she's in a relationship, and she goes away on to solve crime and things on a case. And she never calls home.
I want to ask you if some of the characters are coming back from this book, but I don't want to spoil anything. I'm thinking of one character in particular that I...
The one character in particular you're thinking of is yes. He will be coming back.
See, we didn't spoil anything either.
No, we didn't. And everybody listening is going, who is it? I'm pretty sure he will be in the next book. Not 100% sure, because I've been making a list. Like I said, I have two ideas right now that are in a race to see which idea gets the most pages first. Mm-hmm. It's unusual for me to have two ideas this strong.
Is that a good sign?
I'll let you know. I like I said, I've never had this happen before. I've had a Mary book and an Anita book vying for each other to see which would want to be written next. That I've had before. But I've never had two ideas, both in the same series, so strong and so ready to go before. That is brand new. And, you know, that's one of the things I love about my job. And I love about the fact that I'm willing to be challenged. I'm willing to change how I do things. I'm willing to shake it up. If my characters and my muse are wanting to do something different, I'm ready to follow.
Well, what will be the toughest thing when you go to write your next book? What will be the toughest thing for you?
Toughest thing for me. Both these ideas are out of town. I'm going to have to find time in the schedule not just to write the book, but to do some extra legwork in the two cities, because though I've been to both cities more than once, my rule is if I have to have been to a city, I'm going to write in at least a couple of times.
Good. That's a good idea.
and then, well, some writers seem to be able to read a travel book, and they seem to be fine with that. I'm not. I'm one of those writers that really works better if I can walk the street, if I can, you know, be there at least some of the time. The exception to this rule is Obsidian Butterfly, where Edward told me he lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I said, you can't live in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I've never been there. You're my imaginary creation. You can't live someplace I've never been.
Now, you were born in St. Louis?
No. I was born actually in Little Rock.
I was born in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Well,
you were born in Arkansas. Okay. Yeah. We haven't even mentioned St. Louis, and that's where...
I've written... Every Anita book has been written here. That's why, you know, she's set here.
Are you superstitious about that?
How so?
That you always have to write him in St. Louis is what I'm saying.
No. Oh, heavens, no. No. I've written parts of book on international flights to Europe.
Wow.
I don't sleep on planes, so since international flights take a long, long time, I work, and I'll do dozens of pages on a flight.
Wow, that's cool. A lot of authors don't do that.
I used to be phobic of flying, quite severely. So writing on the plane was the most thought-intensive thing, the thing that allowed me to pretend I wasn't on a plane.
Makes me want to ask you what you're afraid of. Obviously, you said everybody's afraid of the dark. You are indeed afraid of the dark?
I'm not afraid of the dark, but I am afraid if I'm in the dark and I hear something and I don't know what it is, it's a bad
right.
one. Everybody is. It's not a phobia. It's just your lizard brain kicking in going, it will eat you.
Right. Yeah.
I actually don't share my phobias. But I will say this. There's a wonderful Eleanor Roosevelt quote that says, do something every day that scares you. Well, I'm always ahead of the curve on that because when I started out, I was scared of a lot of things. And what I found is the only thing that ever makes me pause is if I give into any fear. If I just head straight at it, afraid or not, and go right through it, over it, whatever, then I always feel better. And then the next time it comes up, I'm a little more brave. Like, I was phobic of flying, really seriously phobic. And what did I do? I accidentally made friends all across the country. And the only way to get there in a time where you can spend a weekend visiting is to fly. So I have had months in the last couple of years where I have been flying somewhere almost half every month. And I, our last flight, the first flight out for the tour for Hitlist, we were on a plane. My husband had gotten a sinus infection, so for the first time in a decade, he couldn't fly with me.
Oh, no.
And so I was sitting there on my side of the plane by myself, and there was a horrible noise just as it took off, and just as the landing gear was coming up, there was a horrible noise. My first thought was the landing gear had been damaged, and then realized it was quiet. It was quieter than a plane should be. We'd lost an engine. It was still attached to the plane, but it wasn't working. Apparently, it had caught on fire.
And you heard that.
We heard the noise. We heard something go very, very badly
now
wrong.
Now, that must have scared you.
No.
It didn't?
No. I've done my research. I know that a plane is fine with just one engine.
You're one smart lady. You really are very, I mean, that's what comes across, that you're very, very intelligent. And that makes you even more interesting. I don't know what that meant. I didn't mean...
Intelligence is sexy. I'm sorry. Smart is better.
But there's so many depths to you, which is nice. I mean, I could probably talk to you about a lot of different things, and you would know a lot about it. And you've learned a lot from doing your research, too.
Yeah, I have. And the research that I started off with doing for the books and everything, I have now applied, like I was phobic of flying, so I found out more about how planes work. And I knew one engine was fine. I knew we would get down. I trusted the pilot didn't want to die, and he's in front. So he's going to do his very best to get us down safely. Then, you know, I knew it was bad because we didn't gain the altitude. I've flown out enough of St. Louis. I knew that we were too low. So they circled back around, just like I knew they would, and they came back around for the airport. And here I was going, did we just lose an engine or is the landing gear damaged? I did not want a belly landing on the plane. That did worry me. And then we were getting very low and the river was coming up. I'm going, I really don't want to land in the water. That would bother me. That would have frightened me, I think, if we'd finally been in the river.
Right.
Because I know that the Mississippi is not, Mississippi or Missouri, depends on where you are, the currents are bad.
Right.
Wouldn't necessarily want to be swimming in that. But then we made it to the airport, the landing gear worked, and once that I heard that go down, I was a happy camper. And then I found it very interesting. The emergency crews, they flash in lights, they come towards the plane, and then they stop off from the plane. Hmm. And then one of the vehicles drives by the plane. And I thought, what? That's like going to your doctor, and you're in the exam room, and he walks by the door and goes, you look fine. I'm going, no, do something. And then I realized, it's minimum safe distance. Until they know the plane's not going to explode, they don't approach the plane. They, to prevent loss of life, they look at the plane before they get closer to it. They're supposed to.
You do your research on everything. That's wonderful. I mean, you really have to, but you go above board and you know a lot of different things.
I've been told that I do more research for my fiction than most people do for their nonfiction. Which actually kind of bothered me when I found that out. But because I'm going, that's wrong. You should be doing more.
You must go to bed really, really tired, though. I can imagine that all this writing makes you tired very easily, which is good. You probably get a good night's sleep a lot of times.
Actually, it's the writing's going well, it's like an endorphin rush, like a runner's high. And I'm pumped. I sleep really well at night, that's true. But tour and travel, you know, a different city every day or different city every day, that's tiring. I don't know how some of the rock bands do it for months at a time. I'm very impressed by that. Touring companies for, like, Broadway shows and things that go across the country, that's touring. That would be tiring. You know, if your friends are having problems and you become their confidant, by the end of the day, that's tiring.
All right.
But, no. Now, I will admit that when I do an all-night session, sometimes the muse is just working that hard. Sometimes the deadline is upon me. And I have, on Hit List, I did do a 6 a.m. to 6 a.m.
Wow.
At my desk.
Fall asleep?
No. I've never done that before. That was a first. 6 a.m. to 6 a.m. breaks only for meals and using the bathroom.
Gosh, Lauren. Oh, I'm sorry. Why did I say Lauren? I have no idea.
but it's moral.
I know. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I had to get the book done. It was so close. I knew if I just kept at it, I could. And what amazes me is when I do this kind of writing, that not only is the writing coherent and as good as anything else I do, you'd think just exhaustion would set in, but it doesn't. Now, when I got up from that day, though, oh, yeah, I was done. I was stick a fork in me, honey, done. It was pour me into bed and just so tired you're almost crying with it. But with rare exceptions of days like that, no, I find what I do exhilarating. Now, mentally tiring, and if I'm tired in the morning, I do not try to force myself back into an afternoon session until the deadline gets closer. There comes a point where the deadline, you have to respect the deadline if you want to get a book out in time.
And you start feeling stressed when that comes, when the deadline gets close?
No, it's not stressful. It's, I don't know.
It's something.
It's an impetus. It certainly pushes me and keeps me going and makes me go, well, better get going. I mean, right now I'm like playing. I'm throwing things up against the wall to see what sticks for the next book. I'm kind of feeling my way between the two ideas. But as the deadline begins to get closer, as I begin to lose my window to play, I will suddenly find clarity of vision and I'll pick something. I think Mickey Spillane said years ago, he said, people asked him, you know, how do you get inspired to write? And he said, when the rent check is due. And I'm lucky enough that that's not an impetus, but you have to treat it like a job.
Right.
I mean, one of the hardest things about making any kind of art form your job is that it's art. It always has to be art. But you also have to treat it like a job, and you have to be disciplined about it. And if you're not, you can be an undisciplined but wonderful writer and write short stories, and you can write a book every so many years. But to do a series book, to do 1 to 2 books a year, until last year, I'd done at least 2 books a year for a decade. And
I'm getting tired thinking about it.
I was getting tired. I have to admit that. That was when I talked to everybody in New York, and that is one of the reasons that both the series are now Penguin Putnam. And it's also why I started going out of town to play. And I have the friends who refresh me, and who just being around them kind of buoys your spirits. You always have people, and I discovered the West. I went out west for the first time. I mean, I'd gone to California for business. I'd lived out in L.A., but I'd never really been out in the western states, and there's just something about all that sky that really lifts the imagination. I don't know.
I hope you come to east for a tour, because we'd like to see you here.
Well, I don't know where I'll be doing next tour, but...
Keep us in mind, will you?
I will keep you in mind. The big thing is we need to find venues that will be okay with me pre-signing books and then doing the Q&A for like 2 hours on stage. People don't think writers are that interesting.
Oh, well, you're definitely interesting. There's no doubt about that. I could listen to you for hours. You just have so much. You're so interesting to listen to.
Well, thank you very much.
But I mean that. I mean, I won't say that about a lot of people. But you are.
Well, thank you.
And we've got a big bookstore where I work. It's 250,000 books, so we've got the room for you.
Wow, that is. A lot of people don't trust an author to talk for 2 hours and be interesting.
No, you'd be fine. I can tell you'd be fine because you're not boring at all. I mean, I haven't yawned once.
Well, I do appreciate that.
And I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed talking to you as well.
We have to say goodbye. I hate to say goodbye because I'm so enjoying myself, Laurel. This has just been wonderful. I had no idea what to expect, but you're just a beautiful person. You really are.
Well, thank you very much.
This has been... And the book again is called Hit List, Laurel K. Hamilton, and it is out from Berkeley. I'm so nervous I'm saying the title wrong, excuse me. And it's out in all your bookstores in Berkeley, and this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.